This is a lecture series from Tikva Ideas commemorating the Yom Kippur War on its 50th anniversary. Together, over the course of 6 lectures, we're going to explore what we know now about the war and what went on behind the scenes. In the previous lectures, I've explained to you the chain of events that led up to the Yom Kippur War and the strategic considerations that governed the Israelis, Egyptians, and the Americans. I've also told you the story of how Israel faced a military disaster in the first few days of the war and then turned everything around and put the enemies on the defensive. Today, I want to focus on the negotiations that brought the war to an end and the diplomatic aftermath. But first, I have to tell you the story of Joe Alon. Never heard of him? I hadn't either until a few weeks ago. I was talking to a very senior Israeli diplomat. I mentioned that I was preparing some lectures on the Yom Kippur War. I asked him if he'd seen any new material, any books, declassified documents, any commentary, anything that might be interesting for me to know about. The question I should address, he told me, was whether Joe Alon was the man who knew too much. Joe Alon, I asked, who's that? He was surprised that I'd never heard the story. It's fascinating. On July 1, 1973, Joe and his wife, Devorah, attended a party at the Israeli embassy in Washington. After midnight, they drove home to their house in the leafy suburb of Chevy Chase, Maryland. Joe steered their Ford Galaxy into the driveway, and Devorah got out and headed for the front door. Joe went for his sport coat in the back seat. As Devorah headed up the pathway, gunshots rang out behind her. She ducked inside for cover and peeked out the window and noted a light-colored car driving away. She and 18-year-old Dahlia, the eldest of their 3 daughters, then ventured out and they found Joe on the ground, bleeding profusely. They tried to staunch the bleeding with towels, but to no avail. 4 of the 5 bullets that ripped through his body did only minor damage, but one of them hit him in the heart. At the hospitals, the doctors pronounced him dead on arrival. The murder remains a mystery to this day. Major General Joe Alon, 43 years old at the time of his death, was one of the founders of the Israeli Air Force. He fought in the War of Independence, the Sinai Operation of 1956, and also in the Six-Day War. He became the Air Force attaché at the Israeli Embassy in Washington in early 1970, at a critical moment in the War of Attrition. Murders of foreign diplomats on American soil are not a common occurrence. But the FBI failed to identify the culprit. It inexplicably destroyed much of the records of its failed investigation. Although Alon was a pillar of the Israeli defense establishment, the Mossad investigation also showed signs of having been surprisingly lackadaisical. Alon's daughters suspect a cover-up. In both Washington and Jerusalem, those with knowledge of the investigation attribute the murders to Black September, the Palestinian terrorist group that slaughtered Israeli weightlifters at the 1972 Munich Olympics. Alon's daughters expound their views in the Israeli documentary, Who Killed Dad?, which was broadcast in 2011. The theory goes as follows. Henry Kissinger, Moshe Dayan, and Anwar Sadat concluded together that solving the Arab-Israeli conflict required allowing the Egyptians to reclaim their dignity with a small military victory. For the plan to work, Egypt must attack and Israel must defend itself poorly so that the Egyptians could feel that they had achieved something. But Israel must also hold on to a piece of Egypt so that the Americans can come in and convince the Israelis to give it up. This is where Kissinger comes in. The American interest is not just to make peace between Egypt and Israel, but to drive the Soviet Union out and to become Egypt's new great power patron. The plan required Dayan to work with a select few people in Israel to allow the Egyptian army to cross the Suez Canal and start a war. The resulting blow would make Israel more receptive to Kissinger's diplomacy. But Joe Alon got wind of the plan. His opposition left the conspirators with no choice but to eliminate him. The Americans killed Alon, so the theory goes, but the Mossad was in on it. One can certainly sympathize with daughters whose father was gunned down on their front lawn, but the theory lacks even the thinnest thread tying Joe Alon to documented events of the Yom Kippur War. Nevertheless, some Israelis who should know better, including a retired Air Force general, buy into some or all of the claims. And they're not alone. Parts of the story receive indirect corroboration from a knowledgeable and influential Egyptian. I'm talking about Mohammed Hassanein Haeckel. Haeckel, you will recall, was the most prominent journalist, maybe propagandist is a better word, in Egypt. He was Nasser's close confidant and sometimes served as a go-between with the Americans. After Nasser's death in 1970, Haeckel became a close advisor to Sadat. In his book, Autumn of Fury, The Assassination of Sadat, which was published in the early 1980s, Haeckel claims that in early 1973, Sadat began to receive an increasing number of back-channel messages from Kissinger, encouraging the Egyptian leader to precipitate a conflict to create an opportunity for American intervention. Throughout his career, Haeckel maintained a relationship with the truth that was, well, let's say, creative. In his earlier book, The Road to Ramadan, which explained the origins of the Ramadan War, as the Egyptians called the Yom Kippur War, he neglected Kissinger's role in the run-up to the conflict. Haeckel wrote The Autumn of Fury after Sadat died, and oh, by the way, after Sadat had imprisoned him for opposing the separate Egyptian peace with Israel. In the second book, Haeckel no doubt intended to settle some scores with Sadat by painting him, subtly but unmistakably, as a tool of the Zionist Americans. He also wanted to interest readers in a subject that he had already covered in detail in the previous book. Like the assassination of John F. Kennedy in our country, the Yom Kippur-Ramadan War is one of those events that naturally gives rise to conspiracy theories. There are many reasons why this is so, but one deserves our concerted attention. Henry Kissinger did not simply manage events in the chaotic Middle East. He, with the help of Anwar Sadat, successfully directed them toward a predetermined goal. One of the most striking things about the conspiracy theories of the Alon Daughters and Mohammed Hassanein Haeckel is how accurately they represent Kissinger's true strategic intentions. I'm a connoisseur of Middle East conspiracy theories. In almost every case, they quickly drift off to fantasy land, imputing to powerful actors dark motives that were unknown to the unsuspecting masses and completely undocumented. In this case, by contrast, the motives the conspiracy theorists impute to Kissinger are actually his real motives. Indeed, no sooner had the Yom Kippur War erupted than Kissinger, who was now Secretary of State, recognized an opportunity. Even more striking, he talked publicly about how to capitalize on it. For example, at a press conference on October 12, 1973, Kissinger said the following. After hostilities broke out, the United States set itself two principal objectives. One, to end the hostilities as quickly as possible. Two, to end the hostilities in such a manner that they would contribute to the promotion of a more permanent and more lasting solution in the Middle East. In other words, Kissinger publicly revealed that he was thinking of using the war as a tool to achieve an important American objective. Kissinger made this statement even before the resupply airlift had started. For Israelis whose family members were fighting and dying at that moment, for those who felt that their very national existence was in peril, Kissinger's utilitarian attitude toward war sounded exceptionally cold and calculating. As we have seen, however, the view of Israel as an instrument in a great power competition was not new. Israel's leaders were very familiar with Kissinger's views and regarded them as an improvement over those of all of his predecessors. Long before the war broke out in 1973, Nixon and Kissinger concluded that Israeli power could be a tool for changing the geopolitical map, a lever that could flip Egypt, then the most powerful Arab state, from the Soviet camp into the U.S. one. To regain its lost territory and reopen the Suez Canal, they reasoned, Egypt had to negotiate directly with Israel. The Soviets could help Cairo make war, but only the United States could help it make peace. Washington could deliver the Sinai and broker a lasting settlement, but only if Egyptian President Sadat would abandon Moscow. Nixon and Kissinger always envisioned a four-stage process. First, providing rock-solid support for Israel. Second, engaging in American-mediated negotiations. Third, achieving an interim agreement that would lead, hopefully, to the fourth stage, a final peace deal. With respect to the American-Israeli relationship, the bilateral relationship, stage one was the most congenial stage to the Israelis. It entailed an offer from Washington of military support against both the Arabs and the Soviet Union. Everything after stage one, however, required the U.S. to stop acting solely as Israel's ally and to begin acting as a mediator, an honest broker, if you will. America had to be Cairo's lawyer in Jerusalem and Jerusalem's lawyer in Cairo. The switch to that role, by definition, would automatically generate unease, if not downright distrust, in Jerusalem. At some point, Nixon and Kissinger intended to put the screws to Israel. The screws started to turn in the last days of the war. 3 days after the beginning of the airlift, the IDF, now assured of its resupply, crossed the Suez Canal in force, intent on delivering a knockout blow to the Egyptians. Sadat failed to recognize the precariousness of his position, but his Russian patrons understood that he was trapped. On October 17th, Soviet Premier Kosygin rushed to Cairo to urge the Egyptian leader to agree to a ceasefire. At first, Sadat refused, but he soon relented. Upon Kosygin's return to Moscow, Brezhnev proposed to Nixon that urgent Soviet-American consultations be held. Nixon dispatched Kissinger to Moscow, where the Secretary of State hammered out the text of a ceasefire resolution very quickly, in less than 24 hours. The resolution went into effect on October 22. The Israeli and Egyptian forces froze where they were. The Egyptian forces were still in Sinai, and the Israeli forces were west of the Suez Canal. The Egyptian Third Army was still surrounded, but safe from an Israeli assault. The Syrians sporadically exchanged fire with the Israelis for weeks after, but Assad, too, was saved by the Soviets and the Americans. The speed with which Kissinger worked enraged the Israelis. They expected him to buy them enough time to destroy the Egyptian military. Kissinger returned to the United States via Jerusalem, where he tried to smooth the ruffled feathers of the Israelis. But the fact remained that he wanted a stalemate, which would allow him to draw Sadat away from the Soviets. In the immediate post-war period, Kissinger began to drive hard for diplomatic progress. Stirred by the enormous risks of superpower confrontation, he moved forward with determination and speed. The first item on his agenda was the separation of the forces on the Egyptian front. The two sides had immediate concerns. Egypt sought the relief of its encircled Third Army, and Israel sought to repatriate its prisoners of war. Golda Meir visited Washington at the end of October, and Kissinger visited Cairo a few weeks later. These trips afforded Kissinger an opportunity to hone what became his trademark diplomatic method, the step-by-step approach, which would soon be known as shuttle diplomacy. The Egyptians and the Israelis soon agreed to negotiate an accord on the separation of forces. But Kissinger went beyond simple mediation. He insisted that the two sides should negotiate face to face. 2 weeks after the end of the fighting, delegations from Israel and Egypt met in a tent in the desert at kilometer 101 on the road from Cairo to Suez. Kissinger employed this system successfully to conclude the first Israeli-Egyptian disengagement of forces agreement in February 1974. It was the first direct peaceful engagement between Egypt and Israel after nearly a quarter of a century of hostilities. Since Kissinger negotiated this agreement nearly 50 years ago, not a single shot has been exchanged in anger between Egypt and Israel. He set in motion a process of military and political disengagement that led to the first encounter between Sadat and Menachem Begin in Jerusalem 4 years later in 1977. 2 years after that, the process culminated in the first peace treaty concluded between the Jewish state and an Arab country. The leading Arab country moved from the Soviet camp into the American camp in the Cold War. In other words, there is a direct line from the ceasefire negotiations that Kissinger mediated to Camp David. Had Gerald Ford defeated his Democratic challenger, Jimmy Carter, in 1976, Kissinger would surely have presided over the process personally. He would have been the one to seal the deal at Camp David. He would have gone down in history as the diplomatic wizard who had ended the Egyptian-Israeli conflict while simultaneously bringing Egypt into the Western Bloc. As it turned out, however, it was President Carter who brokered the Camp David Accords. It was Kissinger who planned the parade. He was the one who organized it when odds of success were small. But at the last minute, Carter ran to the front of the parade and led it as it marched past the television cameras. By the time Carter came to power, Golda Meir had stepped down, The Agranat Commission cleared Meir of direct responsibility for the blunders of the Yom Kippur War, but the electorate was less forgiving. The Labor Party won the elections in December 1973 under her leadership, but lost seats. Meir resigned as prime minister in April 1974 and never held office again. Yitzhak Rabin, who had served as the minister of labor during the war and therefore escaped blame, succeeded her as prime minister on June 3, 1974. Carter came to power 1 year later. In sharp contrast to Nixon and Kissinger, Carter reviled Rabin. The relations between the two men were nothing short of abysmal. The Carter-Rabin talks in early March went badly, writes Cyrus Vance, that's Jimmy Carter's Secretary of State, in his memoirs, after Rabin visited Washington in 1977. The chemistry between Carter and Rabin was poor, and the two appeared to grate on each other's nerves, Vance continued. Carter himself writes in his diary that Rabin was, quote, one of the most ineffective persons I've ever met, unquote. It's not hard to understand why. Rabin came from the Kissinger school of Arab-Israeli negotiations. Two words sum up Carter's core beliefs on the Middle East: comprehensive peace. Carter rejected the interim solutions, such as the Sinai disengagement agreements, that Kissinger had painstakingly negotiated. Such projects were small ball in Carter's thinking. They were inherently unstable. In Carter's view, everything in the Middle East was connected to everything else, so it was necessary to solve the whole entire conflict all at once. The West Bank, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Israeli-Syrian relations, everything. What we needed was a grand multilateral forum. It was Kissinger who had first convened such a conference in Geneva in December of 1973, but he had used it primarily as an umbrella under which to conduct his personal diplomacy. Now it had to be revamped and revitalized, and, in a key point for Carter, it had to be co-chaired by the Soviet Union. For the Israelis, the American intention to give the Soviets a central role in the diplomacy was disturbing enough. Even more troubling was Carter's conviction that the Palestinian question, as opposed to the Egyptian-Israeli military contest or the Soviet-American competition, was the center of gravity in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Carter believed, in essence, that Israeli suppression of Palestinian nationalism was the core problem to be solved. The entire Carter team, moreover, was imbued with an unshakable certainty that all of the Arab states bordering Israel, especially Syria, stood ready for peace, provided, that is, that they could be assured that Israel would return to the 1949 armistice lines and that the Palestinians would receive a homeland. Throughout this lecture series, I have, I hereby admit, neglected the Syrian dimension of the Yom Kippur War. This was not an act of criminal negligence. It was certainly not a mehdal. It was a conscious choice. If we had had time for more lectures, I would gladly analyze the Syrian role in greater depth. But the simple fact is that the Syrians were the junior partner in the Arab coalition. They played no role in the peacemaking afterwards. President Assad was cut from an entirely different cloth from Sadat. He was ruthless, he was cunning, he was humorless. He was suspicious of all foreigners because he doubted the loyalty of his own people. He was ever on the lookout for coup plotters and their foreign backers. He had absolutely no desire to mimic Sadat in moving into the American camp, and Kissinger's charms were entirely lost on him. But Jimmy Carter did not share my views on Assad. He began his foray into Middle East peacemaking, believing that the Syrian leader was on the brink of peace with Israel, and that that fact was something on which American policy could build. This Syria delusion was part of a larger conceptualization of the Middle East. Carter and his team saw the political landscape of the region as divided between, on the one side, the Arabs as a bloc, and on the other side, Israel. He had no sense of the complex and sometimes bitter rivalries among the Arab states. In Carter's view, the United States was caught in the middle, a position that gave it no choice but to mediate between the two sides with an eye to reaching an understanding with the Arabs by forcing Israel to compromise, of course. This is the same view that Secretary of State Rogers held in 1970 when Kissinger fought him tooth and nail. I called it, in a previous lecture, the honest broker approach to the Middle East. The honest broker approach downgraded the Egyptian-Israeli diplomatic track, which Kissinger had supercharged. In 1977, the White House received the news of the election of Menachem Begin with grave foreboding. In Israel, Begin's election is called the Mahapach, meaning upheaval, because it represented the fall from power of the Israeli Labor Party, which had been the leading force in Israeli politics from the foundation of the state. There were many factors behind the Mahapach, but one of them was the belated impact of the Yom Kippur War, which did much to delegitimate the ruling elite. From Carter's point of view, however, the biggest problems with Begin were his opposition to territorial compromise on the West Bank and his rejection of the Palestine Liberation Organization as a legitimate interlocutor. Carter and his team believed that Begin's rise dealt a severe blow to the comprehensive peace that they so zealously pursued. Imagine their surprise then, on November 19, 1977, when Anwar Sadat flew to Jerusalem and, before the Knesset, delivered his message of no more war, no more bloodshed. The event stunned Washington. Nothing in the Carter administration's worldview allowed it to comprehend why an Arab leader would jump into the loving arms of Menachem Begin. To the administration, the Arab world reacted to Israel as a single organism, an organism, moreover, that engaged with the United States and the Soviet Union according to Arab-Israeli dynamics. Hardline Israeli governments pushed the Arab organism toward Moscow. A conciliatory government pulled it back toward Washington. With this absurd mechanistic picture in its head, Washington was completely unequipped to make sense of Sadat's visit to Jerusalem. That Menachem Begin would open a secret bilateral channel with the leader of the most influential Arab country, that he would do so without the assistance of the United States, and that this channel would contribute to the greatest breakthrough in the history of Arab-Israeli peacemaking, these notions were, according to the core assumptions of the honest broker paradigm, utterly inconceivable. As it grappled with the gap between its beliefs and reality, the Carter team was thrown into emotional turmoil. On the one hand, Begin and Sadat offered the administration something beautiful, vibrant, and alluring, a path toward an Arab-Israeli peace agreement. On the other hand, what they were offering was also the embodiment of everything that the administration vehemently opposed. The new dynamic was a bilateral negotiating channel. It was, that is to say, a Kissingerian process, Sinai disengagement on steroids. What Begin and Sadat had cooked up was irresistible to Carter, but also inherently sinful. And the pious Carter behaved like he had just committed a sin. He found the temptation of making peace between Israel and Egypt impossible to refuse, but he couldn't shake off the feelings of guilt at his ill-gotten victory. And the guilt, as it so often does, mutated into resentment. Resentment that was directed at, you guessed it, Menachem Begin. The blame game started even before Sadat went to Jerusalem. On October 1, 1977, a joint Soviet-American communique announced plans for a multilateral Arab-Israeli summit in Geneva. The Israelis knew about the summit, but this was their first indication that the Soviets were invited. They were outraged. Israel and its American supporters complained, in addition, about the communique's support for Palestinian rights, quote-unquote Palestinian rights. That phrase, combined with the fact that the Soviets would be co-chairing the conference, generated a fear in Israel that a plan was afoot to impose a settlement by forcing the Israelis out of the West Bank and establishing a Palestinian political entity there. The storm was very damaging to the administration on Capitol Hill, so Carter took steps to calm it down, steps that included a meeting in New York with Moshe Dayan, who had jumped ship from the Labor Party and was now serving as the foreign minister in Begin's government. During a long and rancorous encounter, Dayan mounted a spirited offense, threatening to whip up Jewish opposition to Carter, both in the United States and in Israel, unless Carter agreed to issue a joint U.S.-Israeli memorandum of understanding, pledging American opposition to the creation of an independent West Bank. While Carter did not concede on that precise point, he did agree to a joint statement of principles. In short, he capitulated, and he did so publicly. Dayan's chutzpah, backed by Begin, enraged both Carter and his team. At the Carter-Dayan meeting, Carter told Dayan that, quote, of all the nations with whom we have negotiated on the Middle East, Israel was by far the most obstinate and difficult, unquote. As for Carter's staff, it shared his anger at Israel, but it was also deeply disappointed with Carter himself for giving in to what National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski would call Dayan's quote-unquote blackmail. Brzezinski was certain that Carter's capitulation to Dayan would bring, quote, increasing skepticism among the Arabs as to the likelihood of Geneva producing any constructive result, unquote. That opinion was widely shared. Thus, on the eve of Sadat's visit to Jerusalem, the Carter administration had convinced itself that Begin, and Begin alone, not Sadat, had killed Geneva. In other words, the Jews were killing peace. But Sadat, of course, fully shared the Israelis' distaste for Geneva. Not only was Carter bringing the Soviets into the diplomacy as equals, he also aspired to involve two of Moscow's clients, Syria and the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. His grand plan was the stuff of Sadat's worst nightmares. Assad, I must tell you, soon after the ceasefire in the Yom Kippur War, fell out with Sadat as Sadat started to go his own way in the peacemaking, leaving Syria alone on the battlefield. The Egyptian leader saw no reason why, when his two goals were to reclaim the Sinai and move Egypt into the American sphere, he should be locked in a room with the Soviets and the Syrians, who wanted neither of those things. Sadat went to Jerusalem, in other words, to scuttle Geneva. Sadat's calculations, however, were utterly inscrutable to Carter and his staff. Convinced as they were that their commitment to a comprehensive solution had won them accolades in all Arab capitals, including Cairo, the only conclusion that they could draw was that Egypt had turned its back on Geneva because Begin had killed it. Quote, it was Carter's apparent inability to stand up to Israeli pressure, writes William Quant, then on the National Security Council, quote, that seems to have convinced Sadat to strike out on his own, unquote. The logical contradictions in this viewpoint are obvious. If Sadat was happy with the Geneva framework, why would he create a new bilateral track? If he feared the Israelis had excessive influence over Carter, why would he conclude he was better off acting alone with Begin? But the argument was less an effort to understand Sadat's reaction to Geneva than to explain it away, to reinterpret it so as to conform to the administration's core beliefs. Menachem Begin was instrumental in delivering to Washington the greatest breakthrough in the history of Arab-Israeli peacemaking, and the Carter administration would never forgive him for it. Sadat's gambit eventually forced Washington to scrap the cumbersome and unworkable Geneva Conference. But the Americans never abandoned their Geneva mindset. Even as they supported the bilateral Egyptian-Israeli track, they remained wedded emotionally and intellectually to the goal of a comprehensive peace and an Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank. In his memoirs, Brzezinski explains that he began speaking in public of what he called, quote, a concentric circles approach, building on the Egyptian-Israel Accord, then expanding the circle by including the Palestinians on the West Bank and Gaza, as well as the Jordanians, and finally moving to a still wider circle by engaging the Syrians and perhaps even the Soviets in a comprehensive settlement, unquote. In fact, Brzezinski's concentric circles were a giant labyrinth. Carter and his team inevitably got lost along the way. Grossly miscalculating, they judged all the positive developments that emerged from Sadat's visit to Jerusalem, up to and including the Camp David Accords themselves, against an utterly unrealistic standard of a comprehensive peace. Consider Carter's reaction to Sadat's visit to Jerusalem. On November 17, 2 days before Sadat arrived in Israel, Carter notes in his diary, Begin called, extremely excited about Sadat's visit, complimentary of me. I pointed out the necessity for him to help Sadat, particularly with other Arab leaders, by not letting it be an Israeli-Egyptian negotiation involving the Sinai, unquote. But an Israeli-Egyptian negotiation about the Sinai was exactly what Sadat wanted. Carter couldn't grasp that, And Begin, of course, disappointed him. That disappointment accompanied every stage of the negotiations down to the signing of the Camp David Accords. Begin was stubborn, filibustering, sermonizing, prone to interrupt, hostile to Palestinian nationalism, protective of Israeli settlements. He was all of these things and many more in Carter's eyes. And standing behind each specific complaint and investing it with deep meaning was Carter's core indictment. Begin and Begin alone was preventing the Americans from achieving their cherished goal of a comprehensive peace. A whole army of Arab leaders refused to join the Camp David negotiations. Hafez al-Assad of Syria, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, Yasser Arafat of the PLO, Saddam Hussein of Iraq, King Hussein of Jordan, and countless others. But the devout president from Plains, Georgia, never held them responsible for their own actions. He was more than willing to forgive their trespasses, just not Begin's. Carter never regarded the root and branch opposition to Zionism among the Arab states as a primary obstacle to a comprehensive peace. The Arabs did not reject peace with Israel. Begin's extremism drove them away. Carter's passionate belief in this fanciful proposition generated the great myth of the Camp David summit, namely that Begin welched on a promise to him to freeze all settlement in the West Bank. In his memoirs, Carter writes that on day 12 of the summit, Begin, quote, agreed that no new Israeli settlements would be established, unquote. However, quote, he later denied that he had agreed to this, and he claimed that he had promised to stop building settlements for only a three-month period, unquote. Carter claims that Secretary of State Cyrus Vance supports his accusation against Begin. But others who were present in the room dispute this version of events. And common sense dictates that they, not the president, are telling the more accurate story. Why? Because Begin simply had no incentive to make such a concession. The peace agreement with Egypt was a done deal by the time Carter put the screws to him. Moreover, the demand for a freeze came exclusively from the president. Carter himself admits that, quote, Sadat was not particularly interested, unquote, in the issue. What Sadat did care about deeply was the question of settlements in the Sinai. After a long and painful negotiation, Begin finally agreed to uproot those settlements, thus clinching the deal with the Egyptians, who thereafter became mere spectators to the Carter-Begin drama. Carter asks us to believe that Begin, after fully satisfying Sadat's painful demand about settlements in the Sinai, then turned around and made an even bigger concession on West Bank settlements, one for which Begin stood to get nothing in return. Moreover, Carter asks us to believe that Begin capitulated without kicking and screaming and rending his garments. Carter incessantly depicts Begin as litigious and inflexible, except in this story, he's easygoing and pliable. The man whose domestic political reputation hinged on his commitment to the West Bank settlements promised to give up settlements just to make Carter happy? The picture is simply impossible to believe. In any case, on the following day, the last day of the summit, Begin gave Carter a draft text covering his understanding of what the two men had agreed on regarding the West Bank. Even if there had truly been a misunderstanding between the two of them, Begin clarified his position less than 24 hours later. In subsequent years, however, Carter would repeatedly depict the temporary misunderstanding as a stab in the back, an accusation that he would hurl at Begin like a criminal prosecutor charging a defendant. The kerfuffle at Camp David took on an exaggerated significance in Carter's mind because the call for a settlement freeze was his last desperate chance to realize his dream of yoking the Egyptian-Israeli agreement to a comprehensive peace. His dream, not Assad's, not King Hussein's, not King Fahd's, not Arafat's, and certainly not Anwar Sadat's. Carter's own diary provides ample proof of this claim. Indeed, when Carter asked the Egyptian leader for suggestions about ways, quote, to help him with the Palestinians or the Arabs, unquote, Sadat responded with a serene lack of interest, quote, he said, Carter records in his diary, the only thing he wanted was not to aggravate the Jews, unquote. A few days after the summit, Sadat reinforced the point, sending Carter a message saying, quote, not to worry about the reaction from the other Arab leaders. He was not worried about it, unquote. Sadat's advice fell on deaf ears. With the hindsight of 4.5 decades, it is now obvious that Carter's dreams of a comprehensive peace were just that, dreams. They were the fantasies of a well-meaning, I think he was well-meaning, man lost in an elaborate intellectual maze. But this was not a maze of his own construction. Carter was trapped in the honest broker paradigm. Generations of American diplomats and intelligence officers, dating back to the 1920s, constructed this maze. And the gap between dream and reality did not disappear when Carter left office. America's leaders today are as remote from the ambitions and fears truly animating Middle Eastern leaders as Carter was in 1978. If we are to read the challenges of the present clearly, we must shed the delusions of the past. Recognizing the power of Henry Kissinger's ideas is a good place to start. To Israelis traumatized by the human toll of the Yom Kippur War, by the deaths of their own soldiers, their own family members, Kissinger's view that Israel is an asset in a larger game is disturbingly Machiavellian. But the real-world alternative to Kissinger was not an American Secretary of State who would view American and Israeli interests as identical. No American official would ever be as concerned about the senseless deaths of Israelis as an Israeli one. The real-world alternative to Kissinger's view of Israel as a superpower asset was Carter's view of Israel as a liability. The Israeli archives contain a remarkable document from 1971 which reveals Kissinger tutoring Yigal Alon on this core truth. Alon, the former commander of the Palmach, was Golda Meir's deputy prime minister. He was visiting Washington at the time. The question before Kissinger and Alon was how to respond to Sadat's quote-unquote peace initiative. The Israeli record of the conversation captures a side of Kissinger that never appears in American documents. Kissinger, the friend of Israel, coaching the Israelis on how to be more effective in Washington, on how to protect themselves from the honest broker bureaucrats who seek to roll Israel back from the territories occupied in 1967, exactly as Eisenhower had rolled them back in 1957. Kissinger spoke as follows. The situation you confront today is that everybody in the U.S. government wants to impose a settlement on you, at least along the Rogers lines. Get that into your heads, Kissinger said. Alon asked Kissinger whether Israel, in the eyes of the State Department, is, quote-unquote, a liability. Yes, Kissinger answered emphatically. Most of the Arabists, he continued, are colonialists who remember the Arabs in their pre-war image and long for those days again. And the State Department is not the worst of the lot. You have a totally united government against you. You have never been in such a position here before, unquote. Kissinger explained that Nixon was the only person in the American system who could counterbalance the State Department bureaucrats. You Israelis don't seem to understand that you have only one single hope, the president, he said. He advised the Israelis on how to play their hand in Washington so that they never made territorial concessions directly to the State Department. While the department spoke in the name of the president, its own ambitions and its own worldview colored its behavior. Its approach to peacemaking would whittle Israel down and leave it weakened. Kissinger advised Israel to be stiff-necked with the State Department so that eventually the president would have to intervene personally. When making concessions to the United States, Israel should deliver them only to the president himself to ensure that Nixon felt personally invested in the deal. To engage Nixon directly, Kissinger explained, the Israelis had to understand the man. Quote, the president is very good on big strategic issues. He has no particular love for the Jews. He does not give a damn for Israel in the abstract. It interests him only in the strategic context of the Middle East. He told me so. He has a good conception of the strategic significance of the Middle East, unquote. Nixon cared about Israel as an asset in the Cold War. When he believed that Israel's fate was bound up with the American competition with the Soviet Union, then Israel could rely on him. 2 years later, Kissinger's analysis proved entirely accurate. On Friday, October 12, 1973, it became clear to Nixon that the Soviets had launched a massive operation to resupply the armies of Syria and Egypt, who had no intention of ceasing their military campaigns. These facts prompted Nixon to prove to Moscow that he was prepared to match any weapons system that the Soviets could put into the Middle East, and that he could put them into more capable hands, Israeli hands. This calculus was the principal reason why Nixon started the airlift at that time. 3 months before the Yom Kippur War broke out, Joe Alon's family saw him gunned down in the front yard. Neither the Americans nor the Israeli authorities ever explained who pulled the trigger or why. Even worse, the authorities exhibited all of the telltale signs of bureaucratic indifference. His daughters have folded their personal trauma into the national myth of the Mehdal. As his daughters now tell the story, Joe Alon became the first Israeli soldier to die in the Yom Kippur War. The cynical machinations of a feckless Israeli elite and an ambitious American Secretary of State cut him down in the prime of his life. One cannot but sympathize with the daughters on a personal level. Nevertheless, their views do Henry Kissinger an injustice. With respect to Israel's interest, Kissinger was indeed the worst kind of Secretary of State, except for all of the other kinds on offer. Every major decision maker in 1973, whether they're Israelis, Egyptians, or Soviets, or Americans for that matter, every one of them occupied a position of great responsibility during the War of Attrition. It was this conflict that generated the strategic assumptions that shaped the Yom Kippur War.